old child to reunite with his parents. Javier has been a Stegner Fellow at Stanford and a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard, and holds fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation as well. We're going to interview him in Spanish after the broadcast, and we're going to post it on our Spanish website. You can go to democracynow.org and click right through. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Gozer, Messiah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. Test, test. Okay, well, we got that figured out. Sorry about that, folks. Nothing like starting a show with a little bit of a hitch. I'm Paul Roland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We did start off with the great, late, great John Trudell with All There Is To It. And we are going to be talking about the Emperor's Ball, as it were, or the coronation of King Charles. And some challenges by a number of indigenous groups around the world calling for an apology, and not just, but actual reparations, true decolonization. And we're going to be talking about that with my once and once again monthly guest, or possibly co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Good morning, Paul.
It's great to have you back, and let me just reintroduce you. Jacqueline Keeler was, again, a monthly fixture on this program for, I don't know, 2-3 years, something like that. She is a Portland-based Native American writer and activist enrolled in the Navajo Nation, and by way of her dad of Yaktan Dakota descent. And your wiki page, your first thing they all still have is you co-founded Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, which is true, but probably not your most prominent thing that you're doing now, which has had a major influence on the calling out of the use and for the end of the use of Native American racial groups as mascots, sports teams, etc. You are the author of Standoff, Standing Rock, The Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Sacred Lands, which recounts the historic legacy of treaty rights and sacred space underpinning Standing Rock's case against the Dakota Access Pipeline. pipeline and contrasts this legacy with the white entitlement as well as cultural desecrations of the Bundy movement. You also, a few years before that, edited Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, the magical, amazing landscape place in Utah, featuring 15 contributors, multi-general writers, poets, activists, teachers, etc., examining tribal efforts to protect the Bear's Ears by making it a national monument. And I added to those that edited Wikipedia entry for you that you are one of the foremost voices calling out the widespread practice of pretendianism, or non-Native, most nearly always white people posing as Native Americans, often to gain advantages in hiring, contracts, publishing, or the arts, etc. So again, welcome back. I just wanted to, I hope you don't mind throwing this at you, but in our conversation leading up to this program, you just mentioned something that struck me. And I don't know if you want to reflect on it a little bit. You called into question actually the term indigenous as being too vague and sometimes erasing a Native or tribal identity. You want to just talk about what's behind that?
Yeah. A number of us remember. So first of all, another correction, so I don't mean to. For Native Americans or American Indians, that's a specific term referring to people who have a legal relationship nationalities, as citizens of nations, of pre-existing nations that pre-existed and persist into the present day United States government, the coming of United States colonization over our lands, right? It's our lands are the ones that are being occupied that the United States, the most powerful country in the world, claims as its own. So we have a political... We are. It's a political status. It's not a racial status. We're nationalities, right? So we. So this is very different than saying being So with pretendianism, you have people who claim descent, or they claim to be. They even claim to be enrolled. Sometimes less so nowadays, but they begin to speak for American Indians, which is actually a legal term under U.S. law, which refers to, you know, folks like us, folks who are citizens of nations that were here when the United States government came, right? And so, or the original colonies. And whether you're talking about Spanish, you know, colonists for the Spanish king, or colonists for the English crown, or later the British crown, you know, this is sort of who we've been dealing with. And so that's sort of the first thing I would start. But indigenous does... What we've been seeing is, you know, when a pretendian moves in, they take over the Native Studies Department at a university that Native people in that state spend a lot of time trying to get their tribes to have some say-so in these land-grant institutions on their homeland. And then they come in, they take it over, they make it indigenous, so then it becomes open to anybody in the world, right? Because technically, every human being is indigenous to somewhere. And then these people step in with unverified claims to indigeneity. You know, they'll claim to be from some, you know, group in the Philippines or Purepecha from Mexico or, you know, just these things that have not been verified that their families actually have connections to, you know, colonized groups in these countries. And then pretty soon, you know, because of course, you know, the human race outnumbers the number of people who are citizens of Native nations in the occupied lands the United States claims, we are then pushed off the table, and suddenly the tribes, you know, are no longer at the table. And so that becomes a way, because we're quickly outnumbered and quickly pushed off. So the term indigenous tends to just basically erase American Indian tribes in the United States from any sort of say so at all. And so this is why we're trying to get away from it. It's just too general. It's been too co-opted and used for, you know, the personal gain of individuals who we really don't know. And these are people who are not subject to Indian federal law or policies, whose families have not been subject to Indian federal law or policies, but yet they exploit our trauma specifically. And whether you're talking about boarding schools or foster care or what have you, they're there, you know, to put their voices in there and just basically push us out. And that's basically what we've seen that over and over and over again.
But of course, on a global level, I think you probably agree the term indigenous is, the use of the term indigenous is in some ways kind of a hard-fought achievement by decades of struggle by groups around the world, you know, claiming their identity, their rights, their lands, their culture, including, you know, forums like at the United Nations, the indigenous peoples.
I think the problem is that it's not being, nobody's fact-checking anything, verifying anything. I don't think that those folks who fought for that would want to be pushed out by people claiming from other countries to be indigenous, and displaced from the conversation. Or I've attended indigenous conferences for this hemisphere, you know, and I remember going to one, I think it was in Mexico and in Chiapas, and there was a man there, and he had been he's from Chile, right? And but he had been in a political, he claimed he was a political dissident and was living in Sweden, you know, he'd been living in Sweden for 20 years. And I remember there was a woman there who was Mapuche, who was an Indian woman who from the mountains, who, you know, she was a school teacher, she was educated, but, you know, she was, you know, a traditional Mapuche, have a poncho here, she wove, you know, and she was telling us, she was like, you know, that man is not, he's not indigenous, he's not Mapuche, because he was going around claiming to be that. She was like, he's just Chileno, you're just a regular, you know, mestizo Landino man from Chile, and yet he's going around the world at all these conferences claiming to be a member of her tribe. So there's ways in which people begin to promote themselves when, you know, you're in Sweden, no one knows whether you're actually Mapuche or not, and you're from Chile, you know, and so there's no fact checking going on. So you have these people who begin to speak for these communities that aren't from these communities, and whose families, in fact, may be from the other side.
It's kind of a mess. Do you see? I mean, there's certainly, thanks to you and the efforts of many others, this whole issue of, as you call it, ethnic fraud or pretendianism has become, you know, it's really emerged even in the public consciousness to the extent that, you know, it has been covered by major media outlets, and you have written and published and others, and stories have been picked up and amplified. But on a global level, do you see this issue being taken more seriously in some of those, maybe those realms where, you know, like the political forums that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that this is where, with you know, the way in which it sort of, when you're looking at King Charles III and the, I would say that it's colonized nations within the Commonwealth, right, that are protesting, and some of these folks represent, you know, like when Prince William and his wife, Duchess of Cambridge.
Camilla.
The Princess and Princess of Wales, when they went to the Caribbean, you know, they were faced with protests and people wanting to leave the Commonwealth, and these folks represent a number of actions taken by the British Empire and the English government before that, which were which created the situation unequal power and oppression, and within a larger system, which, you know, they call the empire or now the Commonwealth, and a lot of these folks, you know, in these Caribbean islands, the folks whose ancestors were brought over in bondage and stolen from Africa, I would say that this is an issue of colonization. It's better to look at things in the specifics. And so when someone is from a nation in the Caribbean and you're speaking out against it, you have a specific political status, right? But often when you see the term indigenous used in these forums, there is no political status. And this is a problem, obviously. When I was, 2017, I was at the UN, at the United Nations, and for some reason someone had given me a grant to go and, you know, kind of talk to people. That was a 10-year anniversary of the approval of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And so I went and interviewed tribal leaders who would come there for that purpose to discuss the, you know, UNDRIP. And as you mentioned, that particular UN document, it took them 30 years of discussion, I think decades, to get it finally approved. It was, of course, the U.S. and Canada and these British colonial states were the holdouts in approving it. And I think, you know, Australia and New Zealand. But when I was talking to tribal leaders, one of the things they told me, and also indigenous leaders from Central and South America, what they told me was the problems they had with it, and actually some folks from Africa too, was that the UNDRIP made them a target in their own country, Jimmy. And it actually led to, they told me, the deaths of people and by these oppressive governments. And the other thing that tribal leaders in the United States told me was that they still didn't have a seat at the UN. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like if Canada and the United States blocks, representatives from tribal governments and from First Nations governments to have representation at the United Nations. And so I talked to one leader. He was from Odawa from the Great Lakes region, and in the United States. And he told me that he actually, when he was the chairman of his tribe, he refused to come to the UN because he would not come as anything other than a representative of his government. And they would not. The only way he could come was through an NGO, and he felt that was not suitable. And so when I interviewed him there, he said it was the first time he'd been there in quite a while because he had just stopped being chairman. So you see the way in which
Let me just you used an acronym, which is a little bit unfortunate, UNDRIP. But again, it's the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and it came out of this working group of Indigenous peoples, which, as you said, had worked for decades to finally get, you know, basically a watered down version. The whole land rights question is not as strong. And nearly as strong, the whole status as, you know, sovereign nations was completely sidestepped because that opens up too many cans of worms for the powerful nation states of the world, especially, you know, the United States, but just, you know, all of them, China, Russia, I mean, they all have populations that have been historically suppressed culturally, politically, and otherwise. Let me just, we started talking about this. I wasn't sure which topic would tackle at the first. I know you've been working on some more ethnic fraud cases, including the Berkeley professor Liz Hoover, who actually just came clean, more or less. We will be talking about that. But since you opened up this issue of this letter, let me just read real quickly from one article, Al Jazeera. This is from Melbourne, Australia. On the eve of King Charles's coronation, Indigenous leaders from around the globe have called on the British monarch to apologize and make amends for what they call genocide. They put that in quotes, which I think a little interesting. A joint letter published on Friday by 12 Indigenous advocacy groups in former British colonies demanded the new king, quote, acknowledge the horrific impacts on and legacy of genocide and colonization of the Indigenous and enslaved peoples of Antigua and Barbuda, Aotearoa or New Zealand, Australia, the Bahamas, Belize, Canada, Grenada, Jamaica, Papua New Guinea, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. The letter also listed key demands, including a formal apology, the repatriation of the remains and cultural artifacts of Indigenous peoples, financial reparations, and request the king to, quote, help our communities recover from centuries of racism, oppression, colonialism, and slavery. And it goes on to quote some people, signatories of the letter, and talking about some of the height. British colonization began in the late 16th century, and its height in 1922, the United Kingdom, with the monarch at its head of state, held sway over more than 450 million people across nearly a quarter of the globe. Won't read all of it. So I know that a major feature of our discussions in the past was on the colonial origins of the United States, and that it's still basically structurally a colonial system, especially as regards the original inhabitants, your peoples and your cousins and relations. And part of what you're talking about is there's general problems arising from the historical colonization by Britain, France, Holland, and all the other powers that colonized. And there's still these terrible legacies of the results, the ongoing conditions of the people resulting from, because there is still structural colonization, whatever they call it. And then there's the differences, which is partly what you're pointing to, the particular issues and problems arising from the different groups within different, including you're talking about, we're talking obviously the United States. So talk more about what you want to say about, I guess maybe what would the equivalent be in terms of the demands of tribal nations here in what's called the United States, analogous to what these groups are demanding?
Yeah. So, of course, we are not under the British Crown like our Canadian relatives are, or First Nations and Métis folks in Canada, or the sort of direct relationship that folks in the Maori New Zealand and Aboriginal in Australia endure. And I think it's when I compare us to Canada, you know, of course it does seem like First Nations folks and Métis folks Métis don't strictly meet the definition of Indigenous, which is that they pre-existed the coming of colonization. They're a product of colonization, you know, obviously being the offspring of white European traders who were employees of a corporation, and of First Nations mothers, you know, but I do feel like Canada is far ahead of us in many regards. One of those is the way in which maybe it's because, even though I think there are more American Indian people in the United States than there are First Nations people in Canada, they're a larger percentage of the population. I think the population of Canada is, 35 million? Right? And most of them do live right on the border, I think within 150 miles of the border. It's a much smaller group. I mean, you know, I think I've mentioned this on the show before. The Kellogg Foundation in 2017 did a $2.5 million study where they interviewed white people and did focus groups, and they found that 30% of white Americans think they have American Indian ancestry, and this number comes out to about 78 million people. And so you can see how just the number of white people in this country who think they have Native ancestry is like twice the entire population of Canada. So it's quite, but within that, what the Canadian government has done, and of course they've done a lot wrong, but there's also been a lot more prominence to Native issues or First Nations issues in Canada in the media. And so like with the Pretendian issue, they're way ahead of us on that. There's been extensive national coverage with the NYW issue. Of course, it started there 20 years before it started here. And the government funded a $50 million truth and kind of reconciliation commission, or more kind of a fact-finding commission on MIW, and traveled across the country reading first-person statements in communities. A friend of mine was on that commission. And so there's, you know, nothing like that has happened in the United States. They've also done far worse things. Like, when I was in college, I was mentored by an Abenaki filmmaker from Quebec, and she was she worked with the Canadian Film Board as a documentarian, and she did a documentary called No Address, which is all about homelessness of First Nations women in Montreal, and it looks at the Indian Act, which is an act that really devastated a lot of First Nations people in Canada, and which of course we were not subject to here in the United States, but basically stated that if a First Nations woman married a white man, she legally lost her status. They call enrollment or citizenship status of First Nations bands in Canada. She would lose her status, and if she didn't have status, she couldn't live on the reserve. And so basically, even after she may have been abandoned by her white husband, she could not go home, and that's why they ended up on the streets. And so, but we never had a law like that in the United States. That never happened here. A Native woman married a white man and then got divorced, she could always go home, and she never was disenrolled for it, as far as I know. But that was a massive issue there in Canada. But what they have done is that the government has really extended the resources so that First Nations and Métis people could travel. And last year, of course, they traveled to the Vatican, and they spoke with the Pope, and they addressed the issue of the Doctrine of Discovery, which is a doctrine that was named and sort of formulated by a U.S. chief, one of the early U.S. chief justices of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, and he had sort of cribbed this off another legal essay that was floating around in the late 18th century, but the basic notions are that under two Vatican papal bulls, one in I think 1491 and one in 1550, that basically stated that only Christian discovering European nations had title to the land. So the minute that these explorers, representing Christian monarchs under the Pope, the minute they discovered and landed somewhere, then the title, the fee simple title of that land, would revert to that monarch. And so this is still active law in the United States. It's the basis of the land claims the U.S. has over our homeland. And so based on that sort of work by the Canadian government and supporting the First Nations Métis delegation to visit the Pope denounced the Doctrine of Discovery, and fairly recently, and so that. But he spoke about it in terms of Canadian issues, and he also promised to return remains that the Vatican has a huge number of things in its museum for Canadian First Nations people. And but without the active advocacy of the U.S. government, acting as a partner in all this, it's almost impossible to do.
What's interesting, I was scrolling through this article about the letter from the indigenous organizations from the former British colonies, and they don't, that I can see, talk about the that Doctrine of Discovery. I don't know how. I know groups in Australia have certainly brought it up in the past. I'm sure many are aware of it. How could they not be? But it certainly applies. It's the same thing around the world. It was the same. The Doctrine of Discovery is basically the rationale for, uses a rationale for colonization, one of the rationales, all over the world. It'd be interesting. Be interesting to call on King Charles, who's supposedly such a sensitive guy, environmentalist and all. It'd be interesting to call on him, since the English crown was the foremost colonizer in his day. Anyway, we could talk about that. I just want to, we're about halfway through the show. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of this program, and I have back on as a regular monthly guest, Jacqueline Keeler, who is a local Native activist and a writer who has had her own show for quite a few months, maybe half a year, which ran its course. And now she's back on with me, which I'm very pleased that is has happened. I'd also want to mention that we have foregone our regular spring membership drive here at KBOO. But that doesn't mean that we don't need your continued support to keep the station running, because we are, after all, a listener-sponsored, listener-supported station. We depend on you all listening for about 80% of our operating expenses. So we would really appreciate it if you could go to kbo.fm, our website, and click on the donate button to the extent that you are able, and continue to support us. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate all those who did support us during our last membership drive. And we will be having a summer drive coming up, but it's kind of a soft membership drive right now. We're just gently reminding you that we do need your continued support. So thank you for that. Also, at this juncture, I will open up the phone lines. 503-231-8187 is the number to get on with your question or comment to Jacqueline Keeler. So yeah, if you want to respond to that, and you know, if we want to continue this, or you want to go on to again some of your current work on ethnic fraud.
Yeah, we could talk about that a bit. I was looking at the Wikipedia article on the Dr. Discovery, and just wanted to correct some of the things I had said earlier. One is that you know, it looks according to this, and one of the really great books to read about the Dr. Discovery is by a former Lewis and Clark law professor, Bob Miller, who is, he's Shawnee, and he now teaches at ASU Law School, Arizona State. And I would say that it does say here that, in 1580, when Spain protested to Elizabeth I about Francis Drake's violation of the Spanish sphere, which was granted by the Pope, the English queen replied that popes had no right to grant the world to princes, that she owed no allegiance to the Pope, and that mere symbolic erecting monuments or naming rivers did not give property rights.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, of course, you know, she was not under the Pope, you know, at that point,
so that wasn't cited by the John Marshall in his decision.
Yes, it was the colonial government. Once Canada and the United States, and I believe Australia and New Zealand, once they became independent countries, you know, then they began to assert the Doctrine of Discovery, and I think those are the major countries in the world that do. They're all. It's ironic because, of course, the English government was not under the Pope. It was 1553 when the second papal bull was issued. They were in 1493 or so when the first one was, but the second one that cited the bull Dum Diversus, they were not anymore. So, but it was the John Marshall. You know, he was. This is how it was explained to me in my Indian federal law class, was that that basically he was imagined being the head of the Supreme Court of a new country that has no real case law, right? So he was drawing upon all sources from around legal sources from around the world to cobble together and set precedent in this country. And in fact, I don't think I was listening to a presentation recently put on by Bob Miller, a panel he had on the Doctrine of Discovery, and he was, I think they were saying that he didn't even have like the original copies of some of these documents, because, you know, people, they didn't have great libraries, they didn't even have great law libraries. So a lot of the stuff he was looking at was, you know, from like other essays and taken secondhand. And so, yeah, so it's interesting. But it is, you know, still enforced. It's still active law in these countries. I see that it was actually on March 30th of this year that the Vatican, two of their dicasteries of culture, they basically repudiated the doctrine as not part of the teaching of the Catholic Church, Doctrine of Discovery. And also it does note here that... that at Standing Rock, a group of clergy, 524 clergy, they burned copies of some of the papal bulls and stuff. So in protest of that, I know I was my grandmother's family are Dakota, but they are also Episcopal. Many of them were Episcopal priests, and actually her grandfather was the Episcopal priest at Standing Rock when he was alive, and so the Episcopal Church has been very strong critic of the doctrine of discovery for decades now, and of course that is the American branch of the Anglican Church, the Church of England.
Well, you bring up, of course, the Supreme Court, which had such a fundamental role in shaping federal Indian law, and this whole sort of fictitious structure that it continues to deny tribal nations their original title to the land, which, relates to the fictitiousness of a pretendianism. We can talk about that again. We will talk about that soon. But since you brought up the Supreme Court, the name Supreme, it's really, people worry about the imperial presidency, but, it's really the Supreme Court that almost has acted as sort of the carrier of sort of the imperial trappings in some ways. And if you look at the current Supreme Court and the way they're acting, it sort of buttresses that. I don't know. You want to make a comment on that before we go to the pretendian issue?
Yeah, I mean, it was as recently as 2005, the Supreme Court cited the doctrine. And so in the city of Sherrill versus the United Indian Nation of New York, and it was actually the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg who wrote that majority decision citing the doctrine. And that actually affirmed that the Oneida Nation of New York had no title to their land. And so it's a terrible thing. I mean, basically what people in the world doesn't have title to the land, that basically dehumanizes us, makes us not fully part of the human race. Well, and that's still active law, still active
indeed. We could go into more about the situation of the Supreme Court, but that's not really the subject of our conversation today. We do have a caller, so before we morph into your current work on ethnic fraud, let's hear from James. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. So I have a question for Jacqueline. So I guess one of my questions is how American Indians or indigenous people, how do they get out from under the government? Because a lot of the problem that I see is that, especially when it, comes to like blood quantum and all that, is that, as the world increasingly, as it's kind of encroached, like people want to love who they want to love and they want to be who they want to be with, regardless of, what some people in the community might say. But, it just seems like as the generations go on, they keep finding ways to invalidate, as you were talking about, American Indians, not only as a nation, but as a people. So, and it just seems like that they keep moving the goalposts. So the American government keeps moving the goalposts. So what's the plan for decolonization or some insight that you have into that? Because ultimately, it's just a lot of forced charity on their end. They have no desire to recognize American Indians, indigenous people, because ultimately the land is what they want. They don't want a relationship with it. They just want to exploit it. So I guess that's just kind of my frustration with a lot of it, because I'm Chicano, right? And so I kind of see what you're saying about because Chicanos kind of formed after colonization, post Treaty de Guadalupe Hidalgo. So we're not American Indians, obviously. But we are recognized by the, International Indian Treaty Council. So, I guess just from a political perspective, how do we make it so that the government doesn't have that say? Because it's kind of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you're preserving, like, you're preserving the, you know, the I guess the blood quantum integrity, but on the other hand, like, the American Indians, indigenous people need more power. You know what I'm saying? So, like,
okay, let's give her a chance to answer.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I totally agree with you that that is getting that the focus of the colonizer is on exploiting the land, not having a relationship with the indigenous nations and their citizens. The thing with blood quantum is though that the tribes, each tribe in the United States has control over it. So the tribe can vote to change the enrollment policies. And there are tribes that do not use blood quantum, like the Cherokee Nation, right? I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation, which has a blood quantum rule of 1/4 blood. My mom's parents were full blood. My mom was full blood. My Navajo grandparents didn't speak English. They were traditional Navajos. And living a traditional Navajo lifestyle into this century, the concerns about, so another term for blood quantum, here in the United States, we have a citizenship is based on a legal term called jus soli, which means right of the soil. And so, that is very uncommon in the world. That's not normal. Most countries use something called jus sanguis, by Latin, right by blood, right? Most countries do require that that you have the ancestry of. So what the tribes are doing is, in a sense, not unusual. What the United States government is doing is unusual. And in fact, right by soil, jus soli is used primarily in colonized places like the Western, like the this hemisphere, because it was used as a way to displace indigenous people, native people, and bring in other people and immediately start creating a bulwark population to basically overwhelm us here, basically. And so, so I think that people need to, maybe reinterrogate that analysis. The blood quantum issue, an example I would give right away, well, two examples from two different tribal nations. One is the Blackfeet tribe of Montana. So they voted, I think they voted either it was about 2000, circa 2010, I'll say, either 2007 or 2011. They did a tribal vote to reduce their blood quantum. And this movement was led by tribals, former people whose families who had been enrolled in previous generations but could not enroll now. And the reason is that in the 1960s, the Blackfeet Nation of Montana instituted blood quantum. You have to be of 1/4 Blackfeet blood. In Canada, they're also called the Blood, so the Blood Nation, the Kenai Nation, and so on the rolls who have been enrolled by the American government were not Blackfeet by blood. Their families had come from Quebec or and they were Métis because they were part of the Hudson the fur companies. The Hudson Bay Company was one of the largest and oldest European corporations in the world. It was a leader in colonization, in colonizing this continent. And so these people came to trade with the Blackfeet Nation as corporate employees, not as citizens of any indigenous nation, right? And so they were there already when the Americans came, and they could speak the language. They were Métis, so they kind of were not full European. So the U.S. government decided then in the 19th century to enroll them, and they got land. Some of them just took the land, sold it, and moved on. Because they weren't actually members of the tribe. They weren't actually Blackfeet. And so what's happened is their descendants have been disenrolled by this 1960s decision. And some of them are very angry and mad. And so they tried to change the rule to reduce the blood quantum percentage. And the tribe decided not. They wanted to keep the blood quantum. And I spoke to one of the tribal members. Her sister is a missing or Indigenous woman. I was, you know, working on a story about it. And she told me that she had voted against reducing the blood quantum. And I was like, why did you do that? And, you know, because, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm not a huge supporter of that policy. But, and she was like, you know, you just have to have those connections to the nation. Otherwise, we would be completely overwhelming people who are mostly white. And you have to look at, when you look at these family trees of people who are mostly white, like say they're 1/32nd Indian, right? That means like about what, five generations ago, they had one Indian grandmother and the other 31 people were probably from Europe, right? And so you look, and these people before the 20th century had massive families, like 12 kids each. When you build out a Pretendian tree or, you know, a white family tree, you have these gigantic families. And we build these trees out to 4,000 people or more. And all of these people are here taking land from Indians. They are, you know, enslaving, people from Africa. You know, they're doing all of these things. And they're having a grand old time, a grand old colonial white supremacy time. You know, when... when 32nd of your tree is composed of this kind of thing, you're bringing a really different perspective into the tribe. And if you're all overwhelming the you know, you turn them into a minority in their own nation. And, you know, I recognize that being half Navajo, even though my father is Yankton Sioux, right? I'm not like, 90% of Navajos are full bloods, okay? And you know, about 200,000 speak the language, right? It's a tribe of 400,000 people. And you know, I know that I'm not the average Navajo, and I wouldn't want the average Navajo to be like me. I wouldn't want them to be unable to speak their language. I wouldn't want them unable to talk to their traditional grandparents. You know, I wouldn't want them to be like me. I don't want the Navajo Nation to be filled with people like me. Jimmy, I want it to be what it is, Jimmy. I want it to be filled with Navajo people speaking the Navajo language. Of course, you know, the Navajo Nation, you know, is larger than most tribes. It's got a land base the size of Ireland, the population the size of Iceland, is larger than 18 member states in the UN. You know, and, you know, maybe we do need a dating app to make sure we're not dating our, you know, immediate relatives, like if they have that in Iceland, right? And
so, Can I just break in real quick, because we're running down pretty quick.
Sorry.
And let me just, because I do want to cover the Pretendian issue before we go on. But maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, James. I think James might be asking sort of two questions at once, possibly. Well, what you're addressing is this, just the basic survival of tribal, national, cultural, you know, identity of a people in the face of all this. And James might be...
Huh? I've actually written this kind of a, he asked for a solution, and
well, it was more...
what we need is, we need a political solution, because what makes us so threatening is our political status and our claims that come along with that of being citizens of these nations to land base. And I think that what we, and I wrote about this after the Supreme Court case that, you know, removed the Cherokee child from her home, the baby Veronica case, and this was in 2014. But basically, I think that we need to, I did argue in that essay against blood quantum, because I felt it made our citizenship seem less important, that maybe we could use other countries. I think Holland, I think, I can't remember, that has, like, where you, when you turn 18, you have to take a test, a citizenship test, right? I mean, the goal of what the tribes are trying to do is to maintain a cultural basis, and the reason why it's so difficult to do is because we don't have, because our political and our physical autonomy has been so eroded by colonialism. And this is the thing about colonialism, is that it means that anything you have is takeable by the colonists, right?
Yeah.
A couple examples I often give is, you know, my husband's grandmother, her family were Finnish American. And she was telling us that when she was growing up, she had to go to finish school, like after regular, to grow up in Waukegan, Illinois. So she, and the reason why was because her father and his generation, they had actually lost their language, the Finnish language, because their country had been colonized by Sweden. for hundreds of years, or 150 years, their language was outlawed, and so they had to do everything in Swedish, right? So when they declared their independence of Sweden, they had to write it in Swedish. The educated folks didn't know how to read and write in Finnish, right? So the goal was to regain their language, and they have done that, as you can tell, Jimmy. And I thought about the same thing happened in Ireland, where, you know, Gaelic was, you know, they're trying to regain Gaelic now after colonization by England. So, and of course, all the millions of people who died in the Irish potato famine because they were being colonized by England and their crops were being exported, right? And so when you're colonized, everything about you is takeable: your land, your children, your identity. When you're talking about Pretendianism, you know, your everything that's precious to you, they can just come and take it, right? So borders, political borders, are the process by which Ireland and Finland have regained their cultural autonomy and rebuilt it. And so this is what is necessary is political autonomy. And I proposed a thing that at the time, yeah, I named the Federal Indigenous Government, which some people call FIG, and basically it would be a partner government, a twin to the federal indigenous, the federal colonial government, and that the two would work together to support each other. But that by having actual political autonomy and the actual, you know, ownership of our land, right, that we could actually really begin to build native cities, native communities, and so that we can then have. So if you are raised on the soil of Indian land, you know, like the Navajo Nation, you are growing up speaking Navajo, and just like if you were to, you know, if you were to go to France, your children would grow up speaking French. They would become French, right? So that this is the process that we don't have right now because colonialization has been so complete.
So we're just running out of time. Since we don't have any other callers, maybe just a quick response, James, and then we really need to move on to the other issue.
Well, that's basically what I was getting at, kind of, with asking you about blood quantum, because it seems like the solution is political, because in the days when the colonists first came, the indentured Irish servants were given, from what I understand, were given an opportunity by the tribes who were in the original 13 colonies to enroll within them because they liked the way that the American Indians ran things. But the American government put an instant stop to it because they knew that would bolster the numbers.
Yeah, my husband.
So, I mean, just like the idea that, you know, rather than like preserving blood quantum, like preserving tradition through like cultural competency, essentially. So that, like, go ahead.
Yeah,
that's basically what I was getting at. Like, we need culturally competent people, not necessarily
That was when we were in the majority in our communities, where if you came here, you had to learn the language to get on. You know what I mean? Then you could be acculturated. Mm-hmm. But now it's not like that, where, you know, white supremacy is prevalent. You know, white privilege is prevalent, and so when someone comes bearing that sort of cultural competency in white supremacy, they immediately begin to sort of control the situation. And so there's this unequal power situation that's developed, that era, because my mother-in-law's family are from First Nations in Canada, but they originally are from New York State, where they had fought against the Americans in the Revolutionary War and lost their homeland in the Mohawk Valley in upstate New York. Upstate New York is basically the Iroquois Confederacy, right? And so, but yeah, they had, they would take in, it wasn't just, a lot of people were indentured, you know, poor kids were just taken off the streets of Liverpool and Manchester and thrown on ships and stuff, you know, and so, but yeah, it was, there was some of that going on. I mean, the Mohawk people were, would adopt people, but back then it was more, it was a totally different situation. Once again, if we had cities and we had very strong national identities that could take a population coming in, but I think when you're being overwhelmed, and it's a different matter.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, James. I know you did want to talk about this. Speaking of being overwhelmed, the whole question of ethnic fraud or pretendianism is one way that continues to muddy the waters, as it were, and make it difficult to maintain the identity. So talk about Liz Hoover, Associate Professor of Environmental Science.
Yeah, I've been working on an article about that for the San Francisco Chronicle, which, of course, she teaches there at Berkeley in the Bay Area. And so in October, she came forward on her own personal webpage and announced that she was not, she had no Native ancestry. And she's been claiming to be Mohawk, actually, a Mohawk descendant from, I think, from Ganawage, I think, which near Montreal. And also, that's on her mother's side, she claimed, and on her father's side, she claimed to have Mi'kmaq ancestry, right? And she did this huge, she centered herself as an authority in the food sovereignty movement, and she did a whole study at the book as her PhD, and also her only published book, which is about the work of Mohawk women to basically document and to fight pollution of their homeland and of their own bodies, by basically doing a study on their breast milk, right? And so I think Gadzi Cook is the Mohawk woman who led that, and so she did a whole book on it, and so that sort of made her, that put her, and then she did a tour where she went to like 40 tribes around the country and mostly in the United States. And basically documented their food sovereignty activities, and so she quite quickly became a central figure. I think she's in her 40s now, but starting kind of, I think she graduated from college in 2001, and then got her master's at Brown in 2003, and then in 2010 got her doctorate at Brown, and then started teaching there, and so. The question is, did she commit? So she's now, and then she did another on May 1st. She did another statement saying she had done, a whole bunch more study, tried to found no natives in her tree, and she claims that she was raised thinking she was native, doing powwow dancing. We're not sure if that's true or not, because looking at her family tree, there's just no native ancestry there, and on top of that. There's no documentation of her parents ever identifying as Native, not even on their Facebook or any sort of social media, and no news articles. And she started claiming fairly, we found a news article with when she was like 17 years old where she gave herself a Mi'kmaq name. And so it does appear that she began crafting this fairly early. But no one in her family has ever claimed. We don't see them. They're just a white family having a good old white family time. she comes from an upper middle class privileged family, and her family has never had a tough time in colonialism. In fact, quite the opposite. I think her great grandfather was head of the National Coffin Company, which is why they lived in upstate New York. he's from Washington D.C., but he became the CEO. And so, we're talking families, but
so we only
belong to country clubs.
We only got a couple minutes left. I just want to read one paragraph. This is just one of many articles that have come out since she issued this apology. This is from CBS News. Hoover's alleged indigenous roots came into question in 2021 after her name appeared on an alleged pretendian list. The list compiled by Jacqueline Keeler, a Native American writer and activist, includes more than 200 names of people Keeler says are falsely claiming Native heritage. So once again, I guess just, kudos for your work, for being so diligent and actually having some effect. What did you think of her apology? It's rare that someone issues such a, fairly extensive apology.
It is, although it doesn't, she's still claiming that she was taught this story, which I truly doubt, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. And I think she just made it up herself. And then also she's not offering to, what the college students there at Berkeley, and I think graduate students too, they've signed this document where they've also asked her to give up her job because there was an article in the Cal paper where they said that she was part of a cluster hire of minorities they were trying to bring into the field there and into the colleges and at Berkeley. And also they asked her to just put herself back on the market as a white woman. She actually is making, and I spoke on background to a member of her department, she's making $50,000 to $60,000 more a year than the average associate professor.
Uh-huh.
And this is because they got into a bidding war with her from Brown And they also gave her partner, who was a crow, he's a crow photographer, he's a crow Indian photographer, they gave him a spousal hire too, to sweeten the deal, to bring her to Berkeley. So she's making over $200,000 a year. Her partner, she wasn't married to him, Adam Sings in the Timber, he was let go because it came out that he was accused of molesting and grooming young girls.
Well, on that note, which needs more exploration, we can't because we are at the end of the hour. Once again, Jacqueline Keeler, thank you so much for being on my show and for coming back to the Second Wednesday program.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being
One,
held.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies.